The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, verse 18. He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering sight to the blind, setting at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim this to be the year of the Lord's favor. And this is where all of the insiders who have the Old Testament, the insiders who have the law, assume that this is their story. And Jesus says, let me tell you what this is going to look like. It isn't just an illustration that God cares about other people. It's that this is what it means for God to show up and for all flesh to see the salvation of God, for God to make himself known to outsiders.
You're listening to Life on the West Side. Here's Nathan Guy.
Welcome. We are looking for the gospel in every book of the Bible. And we are now in the Gospel of Luke, and you're thinking, how do you look for the gospel in the Gospels? I mean, shouldn't this be as obvious as the nose on your face? Well, the trick up Luke's sleeve is that you would think it is. And sometimes we think it is, and then we find that the gospel that's sitting there on our sleeve isn't really the gospel. Let's talk again about what we mean when we say gospel. Gospel is the headline. It is the story and the declaration that makes sense of everything in your life. So in the ancient world, just like in today's world, you'll have a headline, and that's the big bold print at the very top of the newspaper. And there's a lot of truths that don't get into the headline. There are things that are important to the story. There may even be things that are essential to the story, but they're not in the headline. And the reason why is because those important truths, even those necessary and essential truths, if you list them, and you put them together, you could come up with a whole different story. And the headline is meant to frame and orient you in how you think about everything else. It keeps you from all the tangential stuff. It also gives you the lens through which you see all the important stuff. Without it, we could be sharing the same details. We could be listing the same facts. But we could be telling different stories. That's what we mean by gospel. And so that's why, if you ask somebody, you know, a Bible teacher, what is the gospel? What does the Bible say the gospel is? Well, it depends on who you ask. Because in some cases, they'll say, well, it's as simple as the name Jesus. You look in the passages in the Old Testament where gospel means good news. And the idea is that there is a message about to be presented that's good news. And when Jesus is born in Luke chapter 2, the angel says, I bring tidings, good news of great joy for all the people. And it's the fact that Jesus is going to be born. So the gospel could be Jesus. Or you want to spread it out. Okay, what do you mean by Jesus? What did he do? There's a song in my head. The next line, where is he now? Do you know the song I'm thinking of? What did he do? Well, take a look at 1 Corinthians 15. Here's the gospel, Paul says. The gospel that I presented to you, by which you're saved, by in which you stand. Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. He was buried. He rose again. He was seen. Okay, so it could be Jesus. It could be what Jesus did on the cross and the resurrection. But how does that fit into the larger story? I mean, we've got a whole Bible here. That's just one line. Okay, go to Romans. Romans takes it not one word or one sentence, but five verses. And in Romans 1, 1 through 5, he says, we're talking about who's born of the seed of David. He's the Messiah. He comes through David according to the flesh, and he's risen with power by the Holy Spirit. So he connects with all those prophecies of the Old Testament. And Paul trying to say, it is Jesus, it's what Jesus did, it's what Jesus means. Let's go even further. And in Galatians, Paul says, the gospel was preached to Abraham. So if you go back and you get the promises in Genesis 12 as described by the kings and by the prophets and on, you got it. That's the gospel. So it can be a one word. It can be a one line. It can be one sentence. It can be one illustration. But ultimately, it is one story, the uniting story. We've gone over that so many times. We've gone over it every Sunday night. The question is, why do we keep going over it? I want to show you. In Luke, Luke is the first and the only Gentile that we know of to write a gospel. Now, question about Mark is a different story. But Luke is trying to explain the message. And you remember, the Romans had a gospel and the Israelites had a gospel. The Romans' gospel was that Caesar Augustus is Lord. And now if they conquer your territory, then you are better off than you were before. That's the gospel. Good news. Rome has taken over. Rome will take care of your troubles. You belong to Rome. Good news. If you're an Israelite, what you'd go around telling people in the first century was, we've got the law. We've got the land. We've got the God. And if we've got the God and we've got the land and we've got the law, we've got the goods. The gospel is us. It's our story. It is what we've done, where we've been, the sufferings we've gone through, the hope that we're going to experience. Just watch. The good news is to be one of us. We're cisterns. God's grace is funneled through us and only us. And Luke comes along and says, the gospel that should be as plain as the nose on your face, the gospel on your sleeve, it's not the gospel. Let me pick at both of those, Luke says. Chapter 1, verse 5 and 6. You see something that it's important to underline because it goes against a popular claim that we'll hear a lot. One of the popular claims is that the gospel is that Jesus did what I could never do, because who in the world could possibly keep the law? Would you look at Luke chapter 1? In the days of Herod, king of Judah, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth, and they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments of the Lord. So we often assume, well, the gospel must mean that nobody could do the law, and that's why Jesus came. Luke says, let me clarify. Let me speak of two people who did what God commanded. They kept the law. This is where, if we're going with popular thinking, we should just end the gospel story. Well, then clearly they got it. There were two people who did what Jesus commanded, what God commanded. Well, that's the whole story. But that's the beginning, and Luke says, but that's not the story. If you get near the end of chapter 1, the angel has come and he has talked to Elizabeth. There's been a message to Mary. There's now a prophecy in the lips of Zechariah. And the message is that these people coming, John the Baptist and Jesus, they've got a role to play. And would you look in chapter 1 and verse 76, speaking of John the Baptist, and you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins because of the tender mercy of our God. We still need salvation, Zechariah says. We still need salvation. We need forgiveness. And it will only come through the tender mercy of God. In Luke 2, Jesus is born and the angel says, I bring you good tidings of great joy that shall be for all people. We've heard that 100 times. You hear it in child plays of the nativity scene, but do you realize all of those are key words from the Old Testament? Good tidings is gospel. That shall be for all people. That's all nations. That's Jews and Gentiles. That breaks both categories. That destroys both gospels. I've got something different. What's the old line in Rocky movie where Rocky's eyes are hurting and he's supposed to be punching? And he says, I see three of them. And what's the advice given to Rocky? Hit the one in the middle. I've got the gospel that we're the only ones. We've already got it because we got the law. We got the gospel. It's outside of Jesus. It's in Rome. And the answer is no, you need a third party. Pick the one in the middle. In chapter 3, we have John the Baptist shows up and he's quoting from Isaiah the prophet. And we have this language in Matthew. We have this language in Mark. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. They're quoting from Isaiah, but only Luke keeps quoting. Every valley shall be filled, every mountain and hill shall be made low, the crooked shall become straight, the rough places shall become level ways. What is he talking about? He's saying, I'm about to change the whole way that you see the world. Literally, I'm going to change the whole landscape of your thinking. What you think is up is going to be down. What you think is down is going to be up. You know what he's saying? I'm going to overturn your understanding of gospel. And look at the next line. And all flesh shall see the salvation of God. He seems to imply whatever they've already got, that ain't it. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus gives his first sermon. He's quoting from Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, verse 18. He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering sight to the blind, setting at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim this to be the year of the Lord's favor. And this is where all of the insiders who have the Old Testament, the insiders who have the law, assume that this is their story. It's their possession. So the year of the Lord's favor is when God shows up to favor his people. And Jesus says, let me tell you what this is going to look like. And he uses two illustrations from the Old Testament. And in both of those illustrations, the insiders were hurting. But God went and helped outsiders. It isn't just an illustration that God cares about other people. It's that this is what it means for God to show up and for all flesh to see the salvation of God, for God to make himself known to outsiders. They don't like it. You know why they don't like it? Do you know why they want to throw him off a cliff? Because he's challenging their gospel. Not a small thing. The headline, the thing we hold dear, the thing that gets us up in the morning. If you were Jewish, the headline is, we've already got it. There isn't anything coming that I need. Already got it. If you're Roman, we've got it. There's nothing that little band over there could possibly offer, and there's no help from the sky other than what I've already got from the power and the money and the fame and the luxuries we have. We've got it. And he challenges their gospel. He's got power over everything and everyone, and yet he's healing people left and right. But I want you to go with me to Luke chapter 13. Two very interesting stories about the Sabbath. Did you know there's a small island off the coast of Ireland called Lindisfarne? And on this island, years ago, I think maybe the 6th century, if I remember right, somebody drew some pictures of the four gospel writers and gave them all different heads. Matthew's the face of a human. Mark's the face. Jim, help me out here. Lion. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Chip. John's the face of an eagle. What I like about those is that you see something like the Son of Man in Matthew, and you see the bird's eye view of Christ coming down in John. But Luke's image is of an ox. An ox. A lot of people try to figure out why is there an ox, and the general consensus is for two reasons. Did you know that in the Old Testament, the ox was a beast of burden? It would carry your burdens. And that in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is the one who carries our burdens. I see that. The other thing, and this was a little surprising to me because I'm so used to thinking that sacrifices are about sheep and occasionally a turtle dove. Do you know that oxen were also part of sacrifices, especially peace offerings in the book of Numbers? Oxen are beasts of burdens, and they are the sacrifice that brings peace. I don't know if the person who drew the ox was reading through Luke, but it is interesting that ox appears twice in Luke. These are the two stories. Luke 13, beginning in verse 10, he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. Behold, there was a woman who had a disabling spirit for 18 years. She was bent over and could not fully straighten herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are free from your disability." He laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight, and she glorified God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day." Let's just stop for a second. What could cause someone who's seeing healing being done that brings blessing to someone's life and instead see a rule violation? Somebody whose gospel, somebody whose headline is the rules. That's it. And the Lord said, "Hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day?" Go one chapter later, chapter 14, verse 1. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him on his way. And then he said to them, "Which of you having a son or an ox that's fallen into a well on a Sabbath day will not immediately pull him out?" And they couldn't reply. Oh, if you want to get real poetic, if you want to try to read between the lines, you know, and follow some of those early Christian writers who they're very poetic and they're very free with their interpretations, you might see that if Jesus is the ox, it's interesting that after he's crucified, he lays in the tomb on a Sabbath. He lays in the tomb on the Sabbath, and on Sunday, God pulls him out. But I want to focus more on this question. Why is Jesus so interested in challenging their little thoughts about Sabbath? I think it's because even though Sabbath is good and right and noble, it's become their headline. And that means it becomes a different gospel. Let me ask you something. How many times does Jesus have to say something for it to be true? Just once. How many things does Jesus call us to do that we should do? All of them. How many times does he have to say it for it to be right? Once. How many things does he say to do that we should do? All of them. Believe that. But I wonder if we look deep down and we were real introspective, I wonder what our headline gospel really is. Years ago, there was a good and right critique of what's called the social gospel. And the argument was that for some people, they knew the gospel, and the gospel was, how many homeless people have you housed? How many mouths have you fed? If you haven't, you haven't figured out the gospel. If you have, then you live the gospel. And in other words, the gospel is nothing but good deed doing, helping hurting people. I believe the gospel is social, but I understand the critique of that also, which is, then it's really about the acts performed towards other people, but actually the story. The story, the headline, is not what you did. It's not even what they received. The headline is why any of that matters at all. And that's because Jesus Christ, who is our Lord and Savior, has declared us brothers of one another because he's Lord and King. But if you can fall on that side of the ditch, you can fall on the other side of the ditch. I was in London, and I was with a friend, and we were in a taxi cab. And you only had 2 minutes with the taxi driver. And the friend I was with cares about Jesus and looks for every opportunity to evangelize. 2 minutes. Was trying. Didn't get very far in 2 minutes. We get out of the car. We're in London. And my friend thinks, okay, I got to think of something else to say. So on his way out, he says, I just want you to remember three words. Just remember three words. I don't know what three words come to your mind. Church of Christ. Church of Christ. Church of Christ. The most charitable interpretation, and I think the right one, is this. I want to tell you about God's love for you. I want to tell you about Jesus who died for you. I want you to know that that's the heart of who I am and what I believe. And I also want you to respond to the gospel rightly, properly, and correctly. And I know the people who understand that the way I understand it. So if you'll find them, they'll tell you the whole story. That's what I believe was going on. I think that's right. I think that's fair. And I think that's a good heart. But the illustration makes me ask a question. What is it that gets us out of bed every morning, and when we go to bed at night, what is the promise that makes us feel like we're going to be okay if the Lord comes back? Is it that I go to the church with the right name, that I act to do 5 acts of worship correctly on Sunday, and that I know the 5 steps to salvation? Is what gets me up in the morning and what gives me the comfort when I go to bed at night that I go to the church with the right name, that I know the 5 acts of worship, that I've worshiped correctly, and I know the 5 steps of salvation? Is that my security? Is that my blanket? So much so that if I hear a preacher somewhere saying, Jesus Christ is Lord of the living and the dead, he came to give us a home with him. He is King eternal. Nothing else matters except him. You need to surrender your life to him. You hear that and you say, that's all good and everything, but let's talk about what really matters. What I want to get at is this. Luke is challenging what we hang on to as the filter and lens through which we read and see everything. And when you get to Luke 17, Jesus says, starting in verse 7, if you have a servant plowing or keeping sheep, and you say, come at once and recline at my table, won't you instead say, prepare supper for me, dress properly, serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you will eat and drink? Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you've done all, when you've done everything you are commanded to do, say, I know the gospel. It's getting everything right. Say, I know the gospel. It's I did it and they didn't. I know the gospel. I figured it out. I connected the dots and now I'm safe. No, when you've done everything I've commanded, for everything I say is right and good, you say I'm an unworthy servant. I've only done what was my duty to do. And why is that? Because on the cross, Jesus has a couple of statements in Luke. And one of them is when the people who are putting him to death deserve death. Jesus says, Father, forgive them because they don't have a clue. And when the person next to him has been a brigand and deserves to go the other direction, he says, I promise today you'll be with me in paradise. And when he looks up into heaven, he says, Father, I commend my spirit. And a centurion, a Roman, who has believed the gospel that the truth is sitting on Caesar's throne, looks at this death and he says, truly, this man was innocent. And according to the Old Testament, the only thing that can take my sins away and be my gospel is an innocent sacrifice. The gospel, the lens through which I read everything else, it's not about me. It's not about what I did. It's about who he is and what he's done.
Thanks for joining. No one has ever loved you like Jesus Christ. I hope you feel that love in every sermon that's preached on this podcast. You can find more sermons, transcripts, study guides at nathanguy.com. Please stay tuned for another lesson and rest in the love of Christ.